Okay. So what I'm going to start with is we're going to, the first part of the call is going to be learning a little bit about circle in its various forms. And when we gather in circle, circle is a particular methodology for gathering that I have been learning about lately, mostly by a woman named Christina Baldwin, who runs an organization called Peer Spirit. And she teaches some really quite specific things about circle gatherings. And so I'll explain this in a little more detail later. But one of the things that she always encourages people to do at the start of circle is to do something that is kind of symbolic of entering the circle, so that when everyone gathers and is in circle, you do something like ring a bell, light a candle, or something that kind of just symbolizes now we are in circle, we are in this gathering, and we are going to honor each other in this space. So we have a unique circle spread around the world on this call, and I welcome each one of you from whichever part of the globe you've joined this call. And to welcome you into circle, I have a candle lit beside my computer, and I'm also going to ring my bell. And I encourage you to just sit and listen quietly, and as the bell is ringing out, just kind of center yourself and take a few deep breaths. All right, I'm going to read a poem from Annie Dillard, and it goes like this. There is no one but us. There is no one to send, nor a clean hand, nor a pure heart on the face of the earth, nor in the earth, but only us, a generation comforting ourselves with the notion that we have come at an awkward time, that our innocent fathers are all dead, as if innocence had ever been. And our children busy and troubled, and we ourselves unfit, not yet ready, having each of us chosen wrongly, made a false start, failed, yielded to impulse and the tangled comfort of pleasures, and grown exhausted, unable to seek the thread, weak and involved. But there is no one but us. There never has been. So that's just an offering to you as we start this call. I have to tell you that I am very much, I love to teach, but I especially love dialogue education. So my favorite way to teach is by each person in the circle teaching each other, learning from each other. I believe very strongly that each person that enters the circle has wisdom to bring into the room. And so I want to honor that wisdom. It's going to be challenging on a call like this when I don't know how many people are on the line and I can't see you to see you raise your hand. But at the same time, I do want to honor the fact that you have unique stories, you have unique wisdom and unique ways of seeing things that sometimes you can explain something in a fresh way that somebody that I may not have thought of, and that you'll offer some learning to another person. So I welcome you to be participants actively in this call as well, and to consider how your stories can intersect with mine as we all learn together. So one of the other things that Christina and her partner Anne teach in circle is that it's important to establish the tone of the circle by passing a talking piece at the beginning and doing what they call a check-in. And just, it's a way of grounding ourselves, a way of introducing ourselves and bringing our energy into the circle. I use it when I teach. I find it's a way of kind of turning away from the distractions and focusing inward to the group that has gathered. And so I want to start that way with you. I'm going to invite you to just speak up one at a time. I'll unmute the lines and we'll offer you an opportunity. So it'll be a little bit tricky. You'll just have to jump in. And what I want you to do to introduce yourself is say your name and where you're from, and then tell us, answer the question, what curiosity brought you to this call today? So what are you curious about? Were you curious about, you know, mandalas or labyrinths, or is there a particular interest you have if you were thinking about starting a woman's circle or something? So just tell us what that curiosity is. So I will open the lines, and whoever wants to jump in can do so.
For another 48 hours, I'm in Indiana, but then I'll be living in Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay, you can all be heard now. The controls are a little bit challenging, put it that way. So who would like to jump in and share their name and curiosity?
I can start,
Heather. This is Lisa. Oh, go ahead.
This is Shirley. I'm for another 48 hours in Indiana, but I'm moving to Madison, Wisconsin. And my curiosity, I've had the pleasure of working with Heather in a couple of ways earlier this year, and I'm curious to what new insights I'll gain tonight.
Thank you, Shirley. Lisa, you're
here. This is Lisa Wilson. I just wanted to offer, and I'm in Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana, and I have been drawn to spirals and circles, and they have been showing up in my life incessantly for the past couple of months. So when there are opportunities to learn more about those in any form or fashion, I just pay attention. And that's why I'm here.
This is Susanna Sucha.
Oh, sorry.
I'm in Owen Sound. I'm a Shoshone Mohawk out of Tiendanega. So the circle is always really important to me. And I work with my own people, and I have a new moon women's circle that's new. And this is to feed me. This is my curiosity about circles and mandalas and labyrinths. And this is to feed me so that I can be a better facilitator for this group.
Thank you.
I'm Susan in Virginia. And I'm drawn to the mandala, but I'm also a retired equine midwife. Old mares. So I'm interested in the combination of horses and mandalas.
I'd be happy to talk to you. Thank you. Sorry, there were two people.
I'm Orly.
Orly?
Yes. And I'm from Israel, and I came to this call because I've been a Facebook friend of Heather, and I've appreciated her offerings, and I feel a sort of a kinship from across the ocean. And I've also been using mandalas as a form of my own expression. And I came across mandalas years ago when I read a book by Jung, who was a student of Freud. And he discovered that we have a collective memory when he worked with people who drew in circles. And even though the people were very different, they ended up drawing similar things. And that got me curious, and I started just drawing in a circle. And it became a sort of a journaling for me. And each time I do a drawing, I distinctly remember the feeling that I had at the moment of drawing it. And it got me into art, and I just, so this is part of why I'm on this call.
Great. Thanks, Orly.
You're welcome.
This is Alice from New York.
Allison?
And yes, Alice from New York, yes, thank you. I'm curious about all of it, the circles and women's groups I've been participating in over the years, and I've begun facilitating some of my own sacred circles as workshops and also in my home. Been following your work and your creations and fascinated by them and doing some mandalas of my own. And also labyrinths have been showing up. I went on a retreat last year and there was a labyrinth, and I discovered one in Battery Park in New York. I didn't know there was one. And that has also been just a great place to go to and get grounded. And so, yeah, I'm just happy to be here and grateful that you're facilitating.
Thanks, Alice. Was it you that just posted recently about your daughter doing some circle things around her grad?
Making bracelets and necklaces to...
Right. I thought that was really lovely. A nice way to mark her years in school.
Yeah.
Thank you, Alice.
Thanks.
Who else was there?
Okay, this is Alice Sun.
Sorry, there were two voices there.
Go
ahead. There an Allison?
Yes, this is Allison from Arizona. And I guess my curiosity is just that, you know, like someone else had said that, you know, the whole images and thinking about the spirals and the mandalas and the labyrinths, I'm also right now going through a lot of reflection time because this is my seventh year. I'll be turning 49 this year, and so I'm finding myself really, really drawn to them, the idea of this spiraling journey. So it just seems particularly relevant. So there's lots of reasons, but that would be part of it. Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. I like that seven sevens. Yeah, who is that?
This is Janet, and I'm from Saskatchewan, Canada. And thank you. And I found over the last while that I've begun drawing labyrinths. And so I got started on that. I thought I would start doing mandalas, and then I got totally into labyrinths. And then I've connected them to totem animals. So I'm drawing them in shapes of animals. So it's this thing that just happened. And somebody forwarded your work, Heather, to me and said, I think you need to connect here. So I'm very curious to see what we'll do tonight.
Nice. That sounds interesting. Who else?
Hello, this is Mary. I'm from Fort Myers, Florida. And my curiosity is just connecting with other people who are curious about mandalas and circles and things. I've been using mandalas in my prayer, daily prayer time and meditation, and but I'm not really in touch with too many people that have explored this area of expression and spirituality, so I'm curious about being connected to some other women who have an interest in this.
That's great. Yeah, it's always nice to find community when you have a unique interest that you can't quite explain to some of the people that surround you. Anyone else?
This is Sue from Ohio. And, you know, Heather, when I met you back in Columbus a year ago as a result of the ALIA conference, and you had those drawings on your arm,
right.
It was like, okay, this lady's interesting. And then we friended each other on Facebook and kind of been following you. And just recently, I was completed the book, The Noble Purpose, by Barry Herman. And it was the Noble Purpose Spiral. And for me, I've always been attracted to labyrinths and mandalas. And, you know, we met, you know, I'm a big believer in synchronicity. And so I've felt drawn to learning more about the mandalas. That's why I'm here today.
That's cool. Yeah, that felt like a really synchronicity kind of evening that night in your house, in your home. Okay, I think, is there anybody else we've missed? Okay, in that case, I'm going to... Okay, So now you do have an opportunity to raise your hand, I think, by doing star six if there's something you want to jump in on. I haven't used this technology a lot, so I, bear with me as I learn as I go. So let's start with a bit of a conversation around circle. And this is something that's been kind of a long-term emergence for me, is the whole concept of circle. And it starts showing up in various ways. And a couple of you made reference to that, too. You know, a mandala would show up, and then a labyrinth, and then these things started to overlap for you. And that's how it's been for me for many, many years. And I can't say where this emergence came from. I do know that I've always been drawn to a circle as, a shape in nature and in beauty. But then it started to have deeper resonance, and I started to realize it had, you know, spiritual connotations, and I started wearing, one of the things I wear a lot is a piece of jewelry that is actually a triple spiral within a circle, and it's called a triskelion, and it represents, it's a very feminine kind of deity with a triple, the three muses within a feminine spirituality, and I have three daughters, so for me it also represents the three feminine wisdom keepers that have been entrusted to me in my home. And so a lot of those little pieces came around, and then I was introduced to labyrinths, probably about 10 years ago, and just really felt drawn to them and began walking them on a regular basis. And I'm fortunate enough to have one on the other side of the river from where I live, so I can bike there in the summertime or drive there. On New Year's Eve at midnight, I gathered a small group of women in the dead of winter, in the dark, and we walked the labyrinth with candles, and it was really quite a lovely moment. So I've been experimenting with different forms. I've been, especially this year, I've really made it an intentional practice around making mandalas on almost a daily basis. I haven't been as faithful lately as I'd like, but I do make it my regular practice. And so a lot of the little pieces started to emerge, and I started to realize that they were all kind of connected, that circle was at the heart of all of them. And so I started to explore more. What is this circle? What does it mean? And why does it keep coming up in my life? And I did a lot of reading on it. Circle is really a very feminine shape. It has a really strong presence in nature. If you ever go for a walk, I encourage you to just go for a wander in the woods sometime and take pictures of all the things that show up in circle. And if you see a cut off tree stump, for example, there's a beautiful circle there. There's beautiful circles and flowers, and the spiral shows up a lot in the ferns, that are unfurling as they open, the fiddleheads, I think is the word I was looking for. And so it has that really organic, natural shape. And if you go further, it's also the shape of our earth. It's the shape of the sun, the shape of all the planetary beings. And so it has that kind of, sacred, but very much connected to nature shape. Going further along the feminine element of circle, the other interesting thing is that the circle is the shape of our wombs, and it's a shape of birth. So birthing happens out of circle. It happens in a very natural, organic way. And when you start looking, I spent a lot of years in the corporate world, and when you start looking at structures, and those of you who've been in the corporate world know about org charts, and we have created a whole lot of structures that have taken us away from circle. And not that those aren't good structures, but sometimes they have become so powerful in our cultures and in our workplaces that we have lost touch with our nature, with our feminine wisdom, with circle in general. And so that's why more and more lately I've been feeling called to bring circle in its various formats back into our dialogue, back into the world, and talk about it. What does this mean? How might this shift the shape of our future? How might it change the way that we interact with each other, the way we structure our organizations, the way we interact with Mother Earth? How are those things impacted when we start to look at the various aspects of circle? Now, one of the things that I grew up on a farm, and my dad was somebody who was very connected to the earth, and he liked to teach us, you know, little teaching moments. And I remember him talking about how the circle was really the strongest shape. And there's a reason why trees are in a circular tube-like shape. If you think about the way your water enters the house, it comes in through a tube. And there's a reason why that circle supports the flow of water, why it supports, you know, whatever it is that's transporting through a tube like that. And that's because with a circle like that, the strength comes in the fact that when you put pressure on it, it equally distributes the pressure around the circle. If you were to put the same pressure on a square, it would crumble because the pressure would be accentuated in the corners of the joints. Same thing with a triangle or any other shape that has square sides or straight sides. It would increase the pressure on the pointed edges. A circle doesn't have that. It distributes the pressure equally, and that's why a circle is a good representation of the way that we need to build community and build our relationships with each other in a more circular way. So it's about community, it's about strength, it's about equality, and it's about wholeness. There's the nature aspect of it brings us a picture of wholeness. There are traditions around the world that use circle as a symbol for many reasons, and I'm fascinated by that too. When you start exploring mandalas, for example, you discover that the circle has emerged as a central part of many, many traditions, especially spiritual traditions all over the world, as a symbol for community, but also as a symbol for an entry into the sacred. I have one quote speaking about the native connection to circle. For example, it says, "You have noticed that everything an Indian does is in a circle, and that is because the power of the world always works in circles, and everything tries to be round. In the old days when we were a strong and happy people, all our power came to us from the sacred hoop of the nation, and so long as the hoop was unbroken, the people flourished." And the piece that I talked about, that I took that quote from, talked about how when the First Nations people started adopting the European ways of structuring organizations and structuring their communities and tribes, it began to destroy their culture, and it destroyed circle, and it destroyed their power as a nation. And so I firmly believe we have to revisit some of those old ways of doing things and reconsider how might this help us change the world. So as I mentioned earlier, I have had the privilege of studying circle as a way of gathering with Christina Baldwin, who is one of the kind of pillars in the circle community. There are a lot of people that study and write about circle. Jean Bolin is another one who's written a book called The Millionth Circle, I think it's called. And Christina Baldwin has written a couple of books on circle, one called Calling the Circle and one called The Circle Way, A Leader in Every Chair. Highly recommend her books. Christina, I'm fortunate enough to have Christina as a mentor in my life. I've been to her 3-day retreat with her, which was a really amazing experience. And so I learned a lot about circle through her. And in the book, A Circle Way, I'm going to share some of the things that she shares. So much of this next part comes from her wisdom, and she works together with her partner, Anne, in this. And one of the things, going back to the history of the circle in human gathering, the Chilean biologist Humberto Maturana, and if you're a Spanish-speaking person, I apologize for my butchering of the language, he writes in a book called The Biology of Love that humans first developed language when we moved into familial groups. The closer we got to one another, the more curious and expressive we became. As soon as fire was discovered, some early version of us formed a circle around the fire, experimenting with new forms of expression. Circle is the way humans have always sat together and gotten to know each other. So So circle is fundamental in the way that we sit with each other and the way that we honor each other, and has been throughout history. And really, it was a formational part of why we developed language in the first place, because we sat together and became curious about each other and wanted to express that curiosity and actually communicate with each other. Once upon a time, fire led our ancestors into the circle. It made sense to put the fire in the center and to gather around it. A circle defined physical space by creating a rim with a common source of sustenance lighting up the center. These ancestors needed the circle for survival, for food, warmth, defense, and they discovered that the circle could help design social order. So Christina really talks about how how the circle, the fire, she's always a firm believer in placing something into the center of the circle, and that represents the hearth, or the core, or really the flame of energy that comes, that is part of the circle gathering. And there again, it's as old as history. And so when I form circles, having learned from Christina, I'll always tend to use a candle in the center to represent that warmth in the center. And that center can be seen as, depending on what kind of work you do, it can be seen as the energy force in this room. It can be seen as really the God space or the sacred or the source or your true self. In labyrinth work, we talk about going inward to our source or our self. And so really the circle revolves around that place of God / goddess or self source. But unfortunately, over the years, we have forgotten how to gather in circle. And what's happened really, especially, Christina says, in the last 500 years, is we have let the triangle replace the circle in our cultures. And what we need is a combination of those two things, because circle supports triangle, triangle supports circle, but we have let one kind of overpower the other. And so if you look at the way things are structured, in almost every organization, there's a hierarchical shape that's represented by the triangle. And it's everywhere. I've been in many, many workplaces, and there's always an assumption of a hierarchy, of a power structure. And if you think about the rooms that you walk into on a daily basis, walk into a boardroom and there's an assumption of somebody at the head of the table. Walk into a classroom and there's a place where the teacher teaches at the front, and that's assumed that that person has the power figure. Conference rooms, almost any room that we traditionally meet in, we have built it in such a way that we assume a hierarchy and a triangle. And I remember hearing Peter Block speak, actually that was last year in Columbus, and he talked about how, you know, the way we structure our conferences, the way we structure, you know, almost any learning space, we assume one person brings the wisdom into the room and they stand at the front. And we even structure it, even when it comes to conversation, we call it Q&A. So somebody asks a question, somebody answers. In other words, the wisdom is brought in by that person at the front of the room. And that really struck me when he said that, and I had an aha moment realizing it's true. We want to sit there and be passive in our learning and assume that someone's going to teach us. Well, I don't think that's what the world needs anymore, to be totally honest. And I'd say this partly because I spend a portion of my time right now teaching in a professional development environment, and I find it really quite uncomfortable to be always the teacher in the front and to have students assuming that they can show up and be passive learners and that I'm going to hand them what they need to know and give them lectures, etc. And it's not a comfortable, intuitive space for me to be in terms of their learning and the way that I want to teach. So I'm looking for ways to shift it, and circle is one of the ways that it, or the way really that I think that we can change some of those hierarchical world views. Really in the hierarchy, wherever it is, whether it's your workplace or your office, your school, or even your family, people tend to look for their place in the hierarchy. You either accept your place as being unchangeable, or you strive to move up that hierarchy to get greater, to receive greater perceived stability and privilege. And as Christina says, for the past 500 years, we really have accepted hierarchy over collaboration. After all these centuries of separation and isolation, Circle welcomes us back into a shape where we can listen, be heard, and be respected, where we can think and create together. So the Circle Way is a practice of reestablishing social partnerships and creating a world in which the best of collaboration informs and inspires the best of hierarchical leadership. So it's not that one, like I said, it's not going to replace the hierarchy, but it supports it. And in her book, Christina shares a story of being on an airplane once, and she was sitting there working on the notes for her book, and a man sitting next to her, who turned out he was an airline pilot, he leaned over and was looking at her notes, and he said, "You and I exist in completely different worlds." He says, "I fly a plane, and there has to be a hierarchy. I have to know that I am in charge, and if I say something, it has to get done." And they got into a heated discussion about the value of both, and eventually they came to the agreement that Christina was working primarily in the Circle world, but she accepted hierarchy in where it was necessary. And the airline pilot finally acknowledged that in some circumstances, he needed to also be in Circle, where he needed to listen to the flight attendants when there was an urgent situation, where he needed to work in collaboration with them. So he actually acknowledged that there were places that the Circle supported his hierarchy as well. So that's the interplay of the way the two structures can work together. A quote from Christina, "A circle is not just a meeting with the chairs rearranged. A circle is a way of doing things differently than we have become accustomed to. The circle is a return to our original form of community as well as a leap forward to create a new form of community. Circle may start as one small shift that turns out to be a tipping point." And in support of that, I want to, going back to my teaching role, I want to share just one simple story about that. I teach a course for project management students on effective facilitation. And this past year was my first time teaching that class, so I was very new to it and new to the content. And the first two classes went great, except I had a real challenge with that class. And I taught them one other class earlier and knew this was a challenge. There was a lot of disruption in the class. The class had a tendency to be whispering in the back of the room, to be disrupting me and my teaching and disrupting each other when other people were sharing. And there was a sense of frustration, not just for me, but for other participants in the room, that there was a lack of respect in that kind of, you know, whispering and chatting, you know, distracting people by doing that. And quite intentionally, but the second or third class, probably the second class in, I disrupted the class by saying, "Okay, it's time to push all the tables away to the edges of the room and bring our chairs into Circle." And it was quite remarkable. First of all, the students were extremely uncomfortable with that at first. They thought I was, from Mars or something. With the way they first looked at me, I was a stranger, and it was a strange way of teaching. But it was really fascinating to watch. Once they got into Circle, for one thing, I hardly ever had to bring it up again. There was essentially no disruption that happened anymore. People began to respect each other in a much deeper way. People began to actually listen and focus on what other people were sharing. People started to trust their own wisdom a little more and offer it up and assume that I wasn't just the teacher in the room. I sat in Circle with him, so I became one of the Circle and not just the hierarchy in the front. And by the end of our time together, when that course wrapped up, I asked for some sharing about what their learnings had been. And probably 75% of the people in the class remarked about how incredibly different this class had gone once we had shifted into Circle and once they had begun to work in that kind of formation as opposed to the hierarchical kind of classroom setting. And so that was such a powerful learning for me about how that can change the conversation, change the way things happen, the way people learn, and the way we respect each other. So that was a lot of talking from me. I would like to open the phone lines and ask for if you have any stories, if there are things you'd like to share about being in Circle or questions you might have or... Okay, we are in conversation mode. So if anyone has a story to share or a question about Circle, you can jump in and do so now.
Come out of a culture that lives in circles, that is trying to retrieve that way of being with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So I've struggled the opposite way, where the boxes don't fit, and
right.
So I've always, if I was fishing, swimming upstream, and battering my head on hard rocks. So it's so lovely to hear people doing this, walking the labyrinth, reading books and wanting to know what circle is, and not looking so strangely at me when I say form a circle, because often when you ask people to come together in a circle, they can't form a circle. They're the wonkiest shapes you've ever seen. It seems like a foreign thing. And when you explain that in a circle, you're able to look at everyone else, and they're able to look at you. It's a huge thing for people to realize that. I think maybe it makes some people uncomfortable, but it's an equalizer for sure. You know, it honors the ability that everyone brings to that circle.
Now, there's a lot of this. I'm really fascinated. Somebody who, like you say, had to actually adapt to the other way of being, because most of us, it was kind of the other way around. And like you say, and that's one of the things I try to teach my students, is that when you're sitting in circle, you have to be really intentional about it, so that you look at every person. Because the tension of the students Okay, so moving on, just a few things about what I've learned about Circle and how it changes things, and some of the strengths of it. And I'll read off a list of some of the things that Circle can bring. Circle is a collaborative space. Circle is inclusive and welcoming. Each person is included and very much a part of it. So there are not edge dwellers who don't belong in the room. In a circle, success is based on compassion and meeting shared needs. It's adaptable to emerging needs. So if you learn to meet in circle, you learn to adapt and in a way that a hierarchy would not adapt as well. It's open to questions, open to uncertainties. The leader in a circle serves more as a host. And I use this word serve intentionally, because leadership really shifts when you're in circle. There is no longer the same sense of power in that leader. The leader now becomes the host of the circle, the organizer or facilitator, and no longer serves as the decision maker, the one with authority, et cetera. In a circle, the gifts of each member are welcomed. The wounded are cared for, so there's a sense of caring and compassion in a circle. And some of that is established by what I did at the beginning with a check-in. When I meet with my students in a classroom, I always get them to say, so what's been on your mind this week? Is there something that we need to be particularly honoring of you today? Maybe you're celebrating something. Maybe you were injured this week, or maybe you're stressed out about something. So you bring that into the room and offer compassion to each other. The circle assumes responsibility and also offers freedom. So there is a sense that once you're in the circle, you are responsible to the other people in the room. And so, and one of the things that Christina, the language she always uses is to hold the rim. It's really important that everybody holds that rim, and it kind of, it's, they call, use the language of container. It creates a container of safety so that we can all put things into the circle. We can put our hurts, we can put our frustrations, we can put challenges and also our celebrations and our questions into that circle. And by each person on the edge holding the rim and honoring that space, we are creating the kind of space where that is all welcome and compassion is offered. Stories are shared in circle. Vulnerability is welcome. And it grows belonging, intimacy, and meaning. Supporters encourage or challenge, so they are able to offer each other that. And one of the things I like about circle is that ceremony and ritual are valued there. So the lighting of a candle, the passing of a talking piece, those are all valuable things in building a circle and building that culture. Just a few of the things that Christina and Anne have established in their methodology. They talk about when you are going to call a circle, first of all, there is the personal preparation that is involved. Every person is expected to prepare themselves in some way to engage in the circle. The host needs to invest in additional preparation time. You need to center yourself, and I try to do that even before this call. I sat just quietly for a few moments, just kind of reflecting and centering myself before starting. You need to prepare that space and prepare yourself for being in that space. So there's intentionality around it. And then there's the invitation. And when the invitation I put out online is a good example of inviting people into circle. What reasons do people need to come together? What is the central calling piece? Why are we gathering? Hosting is an important role in circle. We prepare and hold the space for a conversation to occur. And in this case, I play the role of host. What often happens if you have a regular circle going on, you will shift the role of host so different people take responsibility. So it is indeed shared leadership. And then, sorry, as I mentioned earlier, the center serves really as the hub of the wheel or the campfire. And it's good. It's a very good idea to place something in the center that has some meaning. It could be a simple, symbolic representation of the group's intentions, whether it's some shared values or some photos or a candle or some natural objects. When Christina called us into circle for our retreat that I did with her, she had invited each of us to bring some symbol of ourselves, of who we are, and add that into the center, and it became kind of an altar at the center. So people brought little mementos or photos, postcards, or whatever those little pieces that we're connected to that have some meaning and represent who we are. So that kind of represented our center of the circle, our hearth and our self or source. And then there is the start point. As I mentioned earlier, there is some kind of simple ritual that shifts you into circle. And in this case, I rung a bell. I also lit a candle. Often there will be a short reading, a quote or a poem like I did at the beginning. When you gather in circle, it's important to have circle agreements, so it becomes kind of a covenant or a community agreement around what you're, so kind of like ground rules. I don't like the language of rules, so it's more like a way to respectfully engage with people. So some of the generic circle agreements that Christina and Anne teach are these: personal material shared in the circle is confidential. We listen to each other with curiosity and compassion, withholding judgment. We ask for what we need and offer what we can. From time to time, we pause to regather our thoughts or focus. So as I mentioned, there's a check-in at the beginning. So there's each person responds to some questions that, in this case, I asked you what makes you curious or what excites you or what's happened in the last week that you'd like to share. The three principles of circle are rotating leadership, sharing responsibility, and reliance on wholeness. So there's a sense of things shifting. I'm not always a leader. You will be leader next week, et cetera. We share responsibility. And we rely on this as being a whole circle. And we, you know, if somebody steps away from the circle, if we begin to meet regularly, that disrupts our sense of wholeness. And we have to come back to that and see what we need to do to be made whole again as a circle. The three practices of counsel that guide how you meet in circle are attentive listening, intentional speaking, and attending to the well-being of the group. So we're intentional about serving each other in that circle. Okay, so the one other thing I wanted to share is usually in a circle there would be some form of checkout as well. So similar to the check-in, there's a checkout in which people are offered an opportunity to share before they exit the circle. And then the final closing might be another ringing of the bell or some symbolic way of saying we are now departing from this circle. So let's move from there now into the next form of circle. We've talked a lot about circle as gathering, and now I'd like to talk about circle as mandala, so as a creative practice. And the mandala has so many interesting things. I've been teaching, and Shirley mentioned that she was part of my mandala discovery workshop. And as I teach, of course, I learn more and more about these intriguing ways of using circle. The mandala is the Sanskrit word, which simply means circle. So as soon as you turn some kind of creative practice into a circular form, it really can become a mandala. So it's as simple as that. It can be as simple as that, but it can also be complex. I like to take the simple route and start with a big circle on a page, and I do tend to use a square page. But you don't have to. I mean, you can do a mandala anywhere. And then when I start with a circle, I treat it as a very intuitive space. And Orly mentioned Carl Jung, who's taught a lot about circle and has written books about it. And he used it in his psychotherapy as a way of going inward, as a way of entering that intuitive, deeper space that people have, the subconscious. And so he treated it very much as an entry portal, as essentially to our deeper consciousness. And so when you approach it that way, it becomes wide open to your interpretation and your entry point. I do a different kind of mandala every night. I don't have a framework that I wrap around it. I don't have a set of rules around what certain shapes mean or what, in certain traditions that does exist, but not in the way that I approach it. One of the things that Jung teaches is somebody asked Jung once if he considered it art. And his response was he actually felt that it would be reductive to call it art, that did not fully value what it did. It was more about the process than about creating art. And so when I teach mandalas now, I'm very firm at the beginning that this is not about the result or the product. It is about the process of getting to there. So you don't need to think about how beautiful it is. You don't need to think about whether you've colored outside the lines or done something. I just taught it on the weekend at the Horses and Mandela workshop, and at the end somebody said, oh, but mine doesn't look like anybody else's. And I said, perfect. It shouldn't look like anybody else's. And she had a bit of self-consciousness around whether she was doing it right. And I said, of course you're doing it right. You do a circle and you begin there. And so I encourage you, if you want to explore mandalas, start that way. That doesn't mean that you can't take some forms from different traditions and practice those, but start with just creating a circular shape and begin there and let your intuition guide you. Just reading a quote from some of my readings. In essence, then, the mandala form is a visual expression of this universal ordering principle of nature, one of the ways in which humanity has sought to relate to and sum up the awesome universe of which we are a part. Mandalas are, sometimes literally, cosmic diagrams, attempts to represent the essential elements of the macrocosm in an ordered, coherent manner. So the mandala, as I said, represents the circle in nature, represents the sacredness of circle, And what I love about the mandala is that in almost every part of the world, you can see mandalas having emerged in different traditions. One of the most common for us that we've seen the most is the Buddhist mandala. And many of you will have seen Zen Buddhists who make these very intricate sand mandalas. And they spend hours and hours, sometimes days, building these mandalas in really intricate fashion. And it is very much a spiritual practice for them, a meditative practice. They go into a real Zen-like state while they produce this. And they're exceptionally beautiful. And they're very, very meaningful in terms of what the shape is. And you know, a Buddhist mandala tends to be a square within a circle. And that square, there are, on each side of the square, there's a gate. It's an entry point, and that square represents the temple. So by entering into the square within the circle, you are entering into the temple, into the sacred space, and there's usually layers of those squares that go closer and closer to the center. And at the very center, there's often a two-sided shape, a circular shape or something in the center, and that shape represents the deity in some form, and it is represented by two colors or two shapes because it represents the feminine and the masculine deity. And so by making a mandala, you are taking a spiritual journey into that center place where your god or your goddess or source exists. It's similar again, like I say, to the labyrinth journey. Many other shapes, like I say, and one of the other things I was going to read here is about the Tibetan mandalas, the ones I was talking about that have the square within the circle. And those four doors, the gates into the temple, four gates in Tibetan mandalas, these four doors symbolize the bringing together of the four boundless thoughts, namely loving kindness, compassion, sympathy, and equanimity. So almost everything in that circle has some kind of symbolism. Hindu mandalas are similar to Buddhist mandalas and also have fairly similar kind of symbolism attached to them. Again, the Hindu mandala is thought to be the abode of the deity. And the interesting thing about the Hindu mandala is that it is, in liturgy called puja, the mandala is a place where a deity is invoked by the mantra. The placing of mantras upon the mandala, or nyasa, gives it life. And then the mandala is then regarded, like the mantra, as the deity itself and not merely representing the deity. So as you're doing a mandala, it actually invokes the deity, and the deity is considered to be right there in the mandala. So it is very much a spiritual guide, a spiritual practice toward that God space. In Australia, they make a version of sand mandalas as well. They're circular ground paintings with red and white circles, layers of circle. And there again, the alternately colored red and white concentric circles mark the exact spot in the desert where the great ancestor spirit energy is believed to have first emanated from the ground. It is an initiation ceremony of great power in which an older man, a shaman, initiates the others into the primal mysteries of Aboriginal life. Similarly, in First Nations cultures here in North America, there's Navajo Indians that make sand mandalas as well, and those are very connected to a healing journey. In fact, they will place someone who needs healing at the center of a sand mandala, and they will end up pouring the sand all over that person as a way of inviting healing to that person after the mandala is completed. There's other shapes that you'll see in First Nations culture that are mandala-like, that are circular shapes. Dream catchers, for example. The traditional dream catcher was intended to provide the sleeping individual or protect the sleeping individual from negative dreams while letting positive dreams through. The positive dreams would slip through the hole in the center of the dream catcher and glide down the feathers to the sleeping person below. The negative dreams would get caught up in the web and expire when the first rays of the sun struck them. Another traditional shape in Native spirituality is the medicine wheel. And there you will have seen this. It's a circle broken into four quadrants. And each of those quadrants, there's a red, yellow, white, and black in that medicine wheel. And each of those colors, each of those quadrants represents one direction. The four cardinal directions and the four sacred colors. The circle represents the circle of life. And the center of the circle is the eternal fire. The eagle flying toward the east is a symbol of strength, endurance, and vision. East signifies the renewal of life and the rebirth of unity. So they're, again, very much connected to the spiritual journey and the spiritual path. You also find mandalas in many Christian traditions. And some of you may know about the mystic Hildegard von Bingen, who mandalas became part of her spiritual practice. And she made some very elaborate mandalas that are quite beautiful if you ever get a chance to see them. And she would incorporate images of angels and things into her mandalas and found them to be very meaningful for her spiritual journey. You can also see forms of mandalas show up in dance. If you think of this, of Sufism, for example, the whirling dervishes, they spin in a circle, and that's essentially similar to a mandala as well. So all of those, and then the other part of it is, as I mentioned earlier, is the psychology side of the mandalas that is less about the spiritual journey, but still very interconnected, and that's the part that Carl Jung explored. One of his quotes, I'll read a quote or two of his. He said, "I had to abandon the idea of the superordinate position of the ego. I saw that everything, all paths I had been following, all steps I had taken, were leading back to a single point, namely to the midpoint. It became increasingly plain to me that the mandala is the center. It is the exponent of all paths. It is the path to the center, to individuation. I knew that in finding the mandala as an expression of a self, I had attained what was for me the ultimate." And then another quote, he says, "While painting them, the picture seems to develop out of itself and often in opposition to one's conscious intentions." So there is that element of unearthing the unconscious or the subconscious when we do mandalas. And that's what I've really found in my practice. If I approach them intuitively, I can invite something deeper, a deeper level of consciousness that I wasn't aware of. Things show up when I'm doing mandalas that surprise me, and yet I know to be deeply true because they reveal something I hadn't experienced before. So I would like to open it up now again and invite your questions or comments about mandalas. Some of you I know have used them. I would love to hear about your experience using them.
In Owen Sound, I want to just sign off now. I'm having difficulty hearing, and I want to thank you for provoking my thoughts. I've been journaling and drawing mandalas and spirals and circles while we've been talking, and I
great.
Okay, so you got me started. I want to thank you, but I can't hear very well. So, will there be a recording?
There will be a recording. Hopefully, better sound quality than what you've had so far.
That's good. I've heard what you've said, but when we get into the group, it's really difficult. So I'm looking forward to hearing everybody else on the recording. Thank you, and good night, everybody.
Thank you for joining us.
Good night.
Heather, it's Alice from New York. I'll comment or answer your question.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I found your exercise of asking questions around the mandala to be very powerful. I did a couple of those types of mandalas at the beginning of the year, the calendar year, and I just have found... One day I was reviewing them, and I said, wow, a lot of these questions have been answered. You know, when I did the mandalas, I was completely in the dark about some of the things I was asking. And it was just really gratifying to see how, you know, my life answered those questions after posing them that way. I find it very centering and soothing to work on the mandalas. They're just, yeah, I don't do them every day, but I do them often. And sometimes I'll just be on the subway and have a little scrap piece of paper and just start doing one. And it's really lovely. And I definitely believe it opens up our right brain wisdom and solutions. And yeah.
Thanks.
So thank you.
Sharing that out. Any questions? I just wanted to put on what Alice said, and I can share that. One of the things I really deeply love about the mandala is that it does really engage us for thinking through right brain processes. And just like the same way that triangle has kind of taken over our structural shapes and shifted circle out of the way, I find the same thing happened with left brain functions in our businesses, our workplaces, etc. tend to be more formed out of logical, rational, scientific kind of structures. And so we make strategic plans and build work charts and things. And so we get really stuck in a place where we value left brain over right brain. And there's also elements of masculine feminine there as well. And so what I find is it invites you into a place where you can enter a right brain space where there doesn't have to be words wrapped around anything. It doesn't have to be reason. It can be about intuition and creativity and thinking in that way instead. Any other thoughts for us again? All right. Okay, let's move on a little bit, just a little bit more about mandalas. I was going to share with you just a little story about how I use mandalas in a creative way to create the center of the circle, actually. When we go back to circle, I think the two things can be combined, where a mandala can become your creative expression of the circular gathering. When I taught the Horses and Mandalas workshop together with a friend on Saturday, what we did is we gathered people in circle, and I lit a candle for the center of the circle, and because we were meeting in a little workshop space that's part of a horse arena with a sand floor, it worked perfectly. What I'd done is I brought little containers full of colored sand, and I thought, let's, you know, practice a little bit of what the Zen Buddhist teaches about making sand mandalas. So I had each person pour some kind of circular shape around the candle, and as they were doing it, they would stand up and pour the colored sand and say, you know, I am Heather Plett, and I make my mark, and then start pouring the sand. And while they were pouring the sand, they had to fill in the blanks for the statement, today I will. And so it was an intention-setting thing as well, that today I will try to be fully present for whatever shows up or whatever that intention was for the day. It was a really lovely way of starting that circle and setting intention and incorporating the color and shape of mandala. So I had meant to include a simple mandala instruction here, but we're going to run short of time, so I think instead I will send that to you after the fact. And instead I'm going to move on to the final piece of this call, and that is about the labyrinth. And the labyrinth and the spiral are fairly connected in my mind, and one of the things that has become increasingly clear for me is that the journeys that we are on in our life are never linear journeys. And if you consider, some of you will have read Joseph Campbell's writing on the hero's journey. And I think if we consider the hero's journey, or in our case, the heroine's journey, I think we need to think of it as a spiraling journey, that we are not going from point A to point B, but that our journey will be to continually spiral towards the center. And that center, again, like I said, is our truest self, or our sacred self, or however you want to name that. And so we often think, you know, if we just get this education, then we will have arrived at a certain point in our journey. If we do this particular thing, we'll be one step further. And that takes us back to that triangle mode where we're trying to climb up these ladders and trying to get to some kind of pinnacle of our power and our strength or something. But life doesn't really work that way. When you start to look at our personal journey, I like to think of it more as a spiral that's taking us, if you want to consider up a hill or something like that. Now imagine the journey that you would take up a hill. If you tried to climb directly up that hill, you would exhaust yourself, possibly even hurt yourself if it's a steep climb. However, if you begin to spiral around that hill, or if you take a looping journey that takes you back and forth, it often feels like you're heading in the wrong direction, but gradually it's taking you up that hill in a slower way that works for who we are and for our spirits in a much more natural and organic way. And so sometimes it feels in our life like we're looping back to the same place we were. You know, maybe it's a learning that you needed to do. And I just wrote a piece about having been at Alia for the last 3 years and realizing that that was part of my spiral journey, because each time I attend Alia, I learn some deeper learning about myself. And then I think I've learned that, and then suddenly the year later, I'm back at the same place realizing I have to learn it in a deeper way. And that's kind of how the spiral works, even though it feels like we're back to the same place. It's actually one inch closer to center, and so we have to trust that journey. And in the same way, the labyrinth represents that journey. So sometimes you're going the wrong direction. You have to trust the path and trust that journey. So to give you a little bit of a history of what the labyrinth is, the labyrinth actually emerged out of a Greek myth, and some of you will remember that myth, that the story of King Minos, who had he lived on the island of Crete. He liked to attack Athens on occasion. It was just one of the things he enjoyed. He enjoyed the battle. And Minos had, you know, in his kingdom, he had a minotaur, which was a beast, and it was half human, half beast. But he had that trapped in the center of a labyrinth. And the king of Athens, the people that King Minos would often attack, finally said to King Minos, he said, "Look, we're fed up with all this fighting. How about we offer you, as Athens, every year we will offer up 7 of our young girls and 7 young boys to your kingdom, and you can feed those young children to your minotaur, to the monster." And so that became an agreement for about 9 years. That was what was happening, is these young kids were going from Athens to Crete to be destroyed by the minotaur in the center of the labyrinth. But finally, the king of Athens, his son, Theseus, said, it's time to put a stop to this. So he was determined to kill the minotaur. So he begged his father to send him to Crete to hopefully kill the minotaur. And of course, his father didn't want to send him, but Theseus insisted and finally was sent on the ship along with the other children who were going to be fed to the minotaur. Fortunately, Theseus attracted the attention of Ariadne, who is the daughter of King Minos. And Ariadne said, "I'm going to offer you a solution." And what she did is she gave Theseus a sword and a ball of string, and she told him to hide that inside the entrance of the labyrinth. This was the night before he had to enter, and that he could use it the next day once he entered the labyrinth. So the next day, Theseus entered the labyrinth. He told all the other kids to wait at the entrance. He tied a string to the door of the labyrinth, picked up the sword, and unrolled the string as he was going into the labyrinth, got to the center, killed the minotaur, and then followed the string back out. So that's become part of the tradition of the labyrinth. It used to be that, in that case, the labyrinth was a confusing place that you couldn't find your way out of. But in the tradition of labyrinths now, labyrinths are the kinds of places that if you follow the string, you'll get to center, and if you follow it back out again, you'll get to the entranceway. So it's not, it's no longer a confusing path. If you read the literature on labyrinths, they talk about the maze is the one where you're intentionally kind of getting lost and can't find your way and it confuses you. The labyrinth, on the other hand, is the path that always leads to center, and you don't have to rethink your path you're taking. You just need to follow the path and you will eventually get to center. So that's become really a spiritual metaphor. As I say, walking the labyrinth has been a metaphor for coming to the center, to where God resides. And there are a lot of really interesting things when you start to learn about labyrinths. One of the things I just discovered fairly recently, that the labyrinths on the floors of medieval churches cause the walker to move from left to right in a walking meditation. And it's another means of balancing the right and left brain hemisphere. So similar to the mandalas, it's a way of balancing those hemispheres and engaging both of them in a more meaningful way. In the past, In some traditions, religious persons were said to walk the labyrinth on their knees in an effort to express penance or have an altered state experience. So the labyrinth symbolizes the search for the one or God, salvation or enlightenment, the journey to God, a path that leads along many deceptive turns and twists to the center. The labyrinth also symbolizes the many dangers of a spiritual path. For example, one can get discouraged or lost in despair or fall off the path altogether. But if these dangers are overcome, the center awaits as a symbol of love and completion. The thing about labyrinths that I'm learning more and more is that there is symbolism to how you walk the labyrinth, or the portions of the labyrinth walk. And generally, as you walk into the labyrinth, it's considered the releasing, or in some terminology they talk about purgation, the letting go. So it's a releasing, letting go of the details of your life, shedding your thoughts, your distractions, and gradually, as you're getting closer to center, opening your heart and quieting your mind. And then once you're in the center is the illumination, or the receiving part. So it goes from releasing to receiving. When you reach the center, you stay there as long as you like or as long as you feel you need. It's a time for meditation, prayer, and that's really the time when you have released those burdens and come to a place where you can communicate more effectively with your sacred or your God. And once you're there in the center, you receive what is there for you to receive. And then exiting the labyrinth is called the returning, or the union. As you leave, you follow the same path out of the center as you came in. You enter the third stage, which is joining God, your higher power, or the healing forces at work in the world. Each time you walk the labyrinth, you become more empowered to find and do the work for which you feel your soul is reaching. So that's really been my experience with the labyrinth. It doesn't matter how distracted I am when I reach the labyrinth. If I commit to it and just start walking the path, something almost invariably will show up for me. Sometimes I feel really anxious when I get there and I begin to walk, and it's that meditative pace of just putting one foot in front of the other and just trusting the path, entering in and opening myself up, and it's that slowing down of the distractions and letting go. And then I get center, and, you know, to be honest, sometimes I still feel the distractions, there's a lot on my mind or something, but if I sit there long enough, almost always some little piece of wisdom will show up for me, and there will be some kind of deeper learning that I needed to receive in that moment. So it's, and last week while I was in Halifax at Thalia, I took a leadership intensive called based on Theory U, which was a change lab. And some of you may know about Theory U. It's this really fascinating change process that's shaped like a U in the diagrams they use. And it is very similar to the labyrinth walk when I started to pay attention to it, because in the Theory U, there is that sense of going in and sitting with it, letting go of what you need to let go of, sitting with whatever needs to emerge, and then emerging out again with the change or with whatever needs to be changed, and beginning to create something in that next stage. In their language, they talk about the sensing stage at the beginning and then the presencing, when you just sit and let the wisdom show up. And in our case, in this workshop, they sent us out into the woods to just sit with it and see what showed up. And then there's the co-creating and co-evolving at the other end of the U. So the benefits of the labyrinth, one of the things that I find really fascinating about it is that it does not have dogma or theology so much attached to it. Not one of these, you know, really strongly rooted in one traditional religion or another. So you can enter it the way that you need to enter it. You can walk it and learn from it. You can use it It's a very generic kind of meditative thing. It's a way of engaging your body in your meditation, and it can be for you what it needs to be, and it will be something different for you than it is for me. And one of the readings I did recently on it talked about how it can be adapted to your meditation. You can use it for weddings, for memorial services. Women's groups use it. Some 12-step program support groups use it, which I find quite fascinating. I think it would be a neat way to do a 12-step process, and because they really talk about a letting go and trusting their higher power. They've used it for abuse victims, for cancer patients, and many other ways in which spiritual input is beneficial. So just a little story to wrap up. We're getting to the end of our time. I was recently at my favorite labyrinth, and my friend Joanne came with me, and she'd never been before, but she stood at the center, and we were just chatting very casually, kind of after we'd walked the labyrinth, and I was sitting on a bench facing in her, and she stood in the very center, not really intentionally, but she suddenly discovered when you're standing at the very center, there's this echo that happens, partly because the labyrinth is in a bit of a bowl shape. Joanne is a scientific kind of person and right away had an explanation for it, but I stood in the center and started to talk, and for me it became very symbolic of the power and the resonance that will be in our voice once we open ourselves to that source and come closer to our own centers and approach our holiness, really, our sacredness in the center. Our voice becomes stronger and reverberates and gets more power. So I love the symbolism, even though there was a scientific reason for it. So that is the end. We've reached the end of our time and really the end of what I wanted to share on this call. But I do want to open the lines one more time. I would love to hear if you have any closing thoughts, questions that you're going to sit with, or if there's a little piece that's going to be on your mind after this call that you'd like to explore further. Please feel free.
Heather, it's Alice from New York again. Just want to thank you for all that you shared. And I especially enjoyed what you said about the labyrinth journey. And just was great to hear your voice. So thank you. And thank you all for being here tonight to make it happen.
Thank you. I would love to be in the same with all of you. It's more meaningful to me to be able to look in your eyes and connect in that way.
This is Susan in Virginia. Thank you very much for providing this space for us to be together and for the discussion on the labyrinth and the mandala and circle.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for joining us. One last person
Allison.
Before we
This is Allison in Arizona. And I just appreciated it because I've been trying to find more labyrinths around town and to do some experiences of them more. And so you gave me kind of some additional ways to think about them as I find them. So thank you.
Great. With that, I'm going to close, and I hope that you have taken some, I always say from my class, one little nugget that will stick in your mind a day from now or from now, then I feel like I've done my part. So I hope that's okay. If I welcome any feedback or any questions, feel free to email me if want to engage further in the conversation, and I will be sending out the link to the recording of this shortly. So let me just close by ringing the bell one more time and wishing you all a blessing as you depart from our circle. I will ring the bell, and after that I will depart from the circle and go our separate ways, and encourage you to find ways bring circle into the world, because I think we live in a world that is hungry for more circle and more honoring of each other, more conversation, more labyrinths and more conversations. So I encourage you to find your own ways of bringing those into the world. So come to the circle. All right, go in peace.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
Go in peace.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Namaste.
Yes, namaste is what it is.